Hello, I'm Jim Mallard, host of The Mallard Report. On The Mallard Report, along with my guest, we will have a conversation where we will share thoughts and opinions. For more information, my bio, past shows, social media links, and so much more, visit mallard.com. MALLIARD.com.
Jim, are you going to be going to break a few times like we've done in other interviews or not?
No, I just go straight through.
Okay.
Keep the conversation
flow. I may have
flow.
To duck out a little bit before the hour, but Mark can take you home.
Oh, I'm sure. If not, I could take myself home. It's not that big a deal.
Okay.
Welcome, everybody, to the Mallard Report. Yes, the sponsor read. It's still in my hand. Good. Good. VeritiesApparel.com, VeritiesApparel.com. Go over there. Everything is at least 10% off. Some items are up to 40% off. Spring cleaning over there, so go check that out. That's VeritiesApparel.com. Come over to Mallard.com and go over, and you get extra goodies for coming through and clicking my ad because I'm awesome like that. But enough about how awesome I am and how awesome the shirts are. Tonight I'm joined by Vic Manana. Now, you told me differently. Tell me how to say it right now. I told you I was going to butcher it.
It's so easy, Jim. Did you never take Spanish?
No, I took French.
Okay, well, the Spanish word for tomorrow is mañana.
Mañana.
And so it's Vic Mañana. It's Italian, but it's pronounced like the Spanish tomorrow. Mañana.
Let's see if I can get the next guest right. Mark Cushman? Did I do good?
Yeah, like the Cushman scooter. That's pretty easy.
So I promised Vic right before we went on air that I had something that he's never heard in any interview he's ever done, and he's been hanging in suspense for the last, minute and a half or so.
I'm biting all my fingernails off.
Well, it's not the same year, but we share a birth date,
827. Do we really? Wait, and what's your 827?
Yep.
August 27th, baby. Nice.
Told you.
Nice. You're right. I have never heard that in an interview before.
And I'll probably do you one better. I'm also from Western Pennsylvania, but you're down that Pittsburgh way. I'm up north.
Oh, okay. Very cool.
So.
Very, very cool, man. It's a pleasure to be on your show tonight.
So very synergetic, I guess. I'm sorry, Mark. I don't have anything special for you.
That's all right. I'm just glowing in all the happiness between you two.
See if we can make you feel better here in a second. So who wants to start and talk to me about Star Trek Continues?
Well, I can tell you
that should be Vic.
Star Trek Continues.
Yeah.
About 6 years ago, I decided that I wanted to start a web series, and I wanted to make a fan-driven web series that picks up where the original Star Trek was canceled and effectively finishes the five-year mission of the Enterprise, something that had never been done. And there are a lot of, you know, different fan projects out there, but of all varying levels of quality. But I wanted to do one that was just superior and exceptional in as many ways as possible. So we rebuilt the entire soundstage. I cast a bunch of dear friends who are also great actors. I brought in a bunch of friends who were Star Trek fans, but also very talented artisans in lighting and camera and makeup and sound and props and wardrobe. And we have, to date, made 11 full-length episodes that finish the original Star Trek series. We've got over 10 million views. And we've won over a dozen awards. It is a beautiful, beautiful tribute to the original Star Trek. And I fulfill my childhood dream of playing Captain Kirk. Not only am I the exec producer and directed a lot of the episodes and edited the episodes and helped build the sets and did all kinds of stuff, but I also get to play Captain Kirk.
Captain Kirk. So where do you enter this picture then, Mark? I'm a little, I don't want to say confused, but I know there's a connection, but I guess I missed that somewhere online.
Well, I worked for a couple of the Star Trek shows as a writer, and I knew Gene Roddenberry for many years. And I wrote a three-book series on the original Star Trek called These Are the Voyages, which won a Saturn Award a few years ago as Literary Achievement of the Year. And Gene had actually gotten me started on that project way back when, gave me access to all the show files. And he kept everything. I mean, memo after memo after memo, and the production reports and the budgets, and my publisher licensed all the Nielsen ratings for every episode. So we put together this voyage for the fans to take, where it takes them back in time, and they're on the stage, and they're in Roddenberry's office, because we use the memos to create the dialogue. So it's not looking back. You're there witnessing the creation and the making of the original Star Trek series. And Vic and I have known each other for a few years now, and I co-wrote an episode with Vic on Star Trek Continues called Divided We Stand, and worked on a few of the other shows as a story consultant. And Vic has now done an audiobook of my first book. Now, this is a three-book set, one book for each season of the original Star Trek, and these are big books, about 600 pages each. Because they're just filled with these memos, and it's not just trivia. It's an emotional journey watching them make this show every episode. Every episode was a fight. Every episode was a mission. And so Vic now has done an audiobook for the first one, 600-page book. It turned into a 28-hour audiobook, and Vic is the primary reader. He reads my words. But we brought on board, or I should say Vic did, he brought on board about 80 other voice actors, and many of them are not really professional voice actors. Many of them are the original people from the series. For instance, D.C. Fontana, I think the best writer on Star Trek, and she was a story editor and the associate producer. She reads her own memos, does her quotes for some of the people that we couldn't bring out because we've lost them. We had Adam Nimoy doing his dad, and Chris Doohan, who plays Scotty on Star Trek Continues, doing his dad, the original Scotty. A lot of the original people, Ralph Sineski, who was a director on the show, and Joe DiAgosta, who was the casting director, and Clint Howard, who was a guest star on an episode, and on and on and on. And then Vic brought in his cast from Star Trek Continues to do a lot of the voices. And it's really an audio play. And over to you, Vic.
Yeah, Mark and I worked together on some of the Star Trek Continues episodes, and I am a voice actor by trade. I've been voice acting for animated series and video games for about 20 years now. I've done over 300 different animated series and video games, and so when Mark's publishing company started talking about maybe doing an audio book of Mark's books, it just kind of made perfect sense to get me to read them because of my own personal love and connection for the subject matter, as well as my background and experience in voice acting, as well as having a studio in my home. And so I was getting ready to read the books, and I thought, you know, it would be so much more fun to listen to if we brought other people in to be the voices of the other characters. So the audience, in effect, Jim, the listener is going to feel like he's sitting in a room with Gene Roddenberry, listening to Gene Roddenberry tell you about, you know, different aspects of an episode, or of dealing with the network, or of the challenges they faced in the production, or the audience will be listening, feel like they're listening to Dorothy Fontana describe how she wrote this iconic episode or the challenges involved. So by bringing all these other voices in, it makes it so much more entertaining to listen to, and the listener feels like they're sitting there one-on-one with these people recounting their memories and their experiences in making the original series of Star Trek.
So I've got to ask, because that's like 28 hours is more content than I do in half a year for those people out there counting their fingers.
Yeah.
How long did that act? I mean, you must have sat there and talked to yourself probably twice that long.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, Jim, let me tell you. Let me just tell you, bro. I had told myself a long time ago that I was not going to do audiobooks. I mean, I'm a voice actor, but I wasn't really into doing audiobooks. They're very time intensive, as you can imagine. They take a great deal of time, and it can get rather, you know, tedious after you know, a couple hundred pages. But the funny thing is that had I just read the whole book by myself, I probably could have gotten it all done in a couple of months tops. You know, recording a couple of chapters a day or something. But the moment that I decided that I wanted to bring other people in to read all these different characters, I basically doubled my workload. And it wasn't going to mean any more money. It wasn't going to benefit me in any more financial way. But I just felt that it would be so much more fun for the listener to enjoy if there were other people's voices, and they would learn to recognize the voice of Bob Jossman or Jerry Finnerman, or, you know, the different people that were behind the scenes making Star Trek. And so it ended up taking me the better part of a year, not only to record all my own stuff, but then to coordinate 80 different people recording their stuff, then get it all put in place, then get it all mixed and mastered, and, you know, music bumps in between chapters. And it was a very ambitious undertaking, for sure.
So, Mark, I've got a question for you as I yin-yang back and forth between you two guys and try to piece this all together. You mentioned having all these memos, but today, I mean, everything's done via, like, email or text messages or whatever, you know, any of this modern technology. We don't have to get into all of what modern technology is. Is it possible that, like, if somebody in 20 years wanted to come back and rejuvenate what you guys were doing, do you think it's going to be as easy, or is it going to be possible to do that?
Oh, if you keep all your emails, certainly. If you archive them, you can do that. But the nice thing about this, and no other show that I know of went to this degree, and I've worked in entertainment for decades, and I've written several books now on other TV shows, and you know, they would all keep memos and keep files, the show files we call them, but nobody like Star Trek. Gene Roddenberry and Robert Jossman, his co-producer, just kept everything, every note, every draft of every story and script, every fight with the network, every brainstorming session they and the other staff members would have on each episode, and budget problems and so forth. And what they would do is they worked such long days on this show. It was really probably the hardest show that was being made in the 1960s. I mean, they were really breaking new frontiers in every way that you can imagine. So it was a long, long day. And Gene Roddenberry, Bob Jossman, Dorothy Fontana, all of them, Gene Kuhn, they would get home probably at 9 o'clock at night after being on the studio at 6 a.m. And they would mix themselves a drink and sit back in a chair and light up a pipe and start recording in a dictaphone. And these memos would be anywhere from 5 to 10 to sometimes 15, 20 pages long on each draft of every script being made, and other situations like how are we going to afford to be able to do this and so on. And so you really, because they did that and because this was all preserved and I was given access to it, I take pieces of all these things and weave them together so that, and Vic can tell you, having been there with all the voice actors and a lot of these original people, that you do feel like you're in the room listening to them have a conversation about every episode of Star Trek. What are we going to do? How are we going to make it? Why is it so important to us to tell this particular story? How can we get the network to let us do what we're trying to do? And so on. And so you're hearing the creation of every episode. You're hearing the fight to get it on the air and so on. And so it's not just episode by episode that is dramatic, but the arc of the entire story as you see them go through the process of making the show, becoming exhausted, everybody, through the course of it, and the relationship with the network breaking down and becoming problematic, which led to the cancelization of the series because it was just doing too many taboo subjects for NBC's taste in the 1960s. So so it was really a gift that they kept all these things. But certainly, I mean, I would love to see a book written like this on Breaking Bad, you know, or shows like that, and be able to see the memos intercutting and get a feel of what was going on in those production offices and on that soundstage. And I'm sure they have them, but, you know, emails are usually a lot shorter. They're not, you're not going to get a 20-page email.
Not from me, you're not. If you do, you know I've been hacked.
Yeah.
Call me immediately if you ever get a 20-page email from me. So, as Vic, I guess as you were sitting there one day and decided, okay, this is what I want to do. Take me from, okay, the moment of concrete moment of I want to do this to getting something together to do it. How? What's that process?
From the moment of I want to do what? What are you specifically asking?
Starting to film. To produce the show.
You mean my web series?
Yeah.
Okay, well, the first thing that I did was myself and a friend of mine who was going to help with the finances of it, we rented a building in South Georgia, and we started building the sets. We had the floor plan from the original soundstage. And local guys down there and myself and some others went down and we started building the sets. And while the sets were being built, myself and a couple others were writing a story, our first episode story. And while that was being done, I was reaching out and lining up actors to play the roles and camera operators and lighting people and sound people and makeup people and wardrobe people and prop people. So there were a lot of things going at one time. I had a lot of balls in the air, if you know what I mean, trying to juggle a lot of different things because, you know, a regular television production has an entire team and staff of people all, you know, delegated to do different things, and I pretty much was kind of doing everything because it was my baby. We all came together in October, I believe, or January, about 6 years ago, and we shot our first episode, Pilgrim of Eternity. I took the footage home and I edited it, and music designed it, and we released it online, and we didn't know if anyone would enjoy it or not, but you know, we made the best Star Trek episode we could make. And so we released it and people absolutely loved it. They really, really, really embraced it. And so I thought, well, now that we've proven what we're capable of doing, now that we have a finished episode in the can and people can see what we are capable of, if they like it, we're going to launch a crowdfunding campaign, like a Kickstarter, or as we called it, Kirkstarter. And we launched a campaign and we raised enough money to make episodes 2, 3, and 4. Then we launched another campaign to make episodes 5, 6, and 7. And then we launched one more final campaign to make 8, 9, 10, and 11. So we continued to grow, throughout the project. More and more people came on board. I would cast guest roles. Our wardrobe people would create costumes based on the new episodes and the stories and what we were going to need. And we turned into a very finely tuned machine. We had actors. We had guest stars from everything from Star Wars to Doctor Who to Battlestar Galactica, Star Wars, Buffy, Incredible Hulk, Buck Rogers, tons of
the original, Star Trek.
Star Trek. And we had all these great guest stars, and so many of them would come down and do an episode, and when they left, they would tell us, I've been on professional sound stages and multi-million-dollar productions my whole life, and none of them were ever run more efficiently with a better positive spirit of just people really enjoying what they're doing and enjoying being around each other as Star Trek continues. So it was really, really a beautiful production. We had a wonderful time making it. We made lifelong friends through making the production, and we also created and produced some really, really beautiful Star Trek episodes. In fact, Rod Roddenberry, who is Gene Roddenberry's son, not only did he come down and did a little walk-on as a red shirt, did a little cameo, but he has been asked and on dozens of occasions has publicly stated that if his dad were alive today, he would consider Star Trek Continues canon. And Rod has said repeatedly he personally does consider it canon, as good as, and in some cases even better than some of the original Star Trek episodes.
And I agree. I mean, this show picks up with the what would be the fourth season of the original show. And as Vic said, it takes you right up to the doorstep of Star Trek, the motion picture, at the end of the original five-year mission. And but first of all, we need to understand that Vic is working with professionals. These aren't just a bunch of fans who out in the middle of nowhere who got together and decided to put on a show. I mean, these are professional actors, professional technicians. I mean, he's got people like Doug Drexler, who's won Academy Awards and Emmys for working on Star Trek movies and TV series, doing the Enterprise shots and so on. So I mean, it's top line talent, but people who love the show, and they weren't getting what they wanted. Vic, if I'm wrong, please correct me, but I can speak for myself, and I think I can speak for all of you. They weren't getting what they wanted from the owners of the Star Trek franchise. So they put together the show that they knew that we, the fans, would love to watch, which completes that first five-year mission.
Yeah, I don't know how big of a Star Trek fan you are, Jim, but the original series was canceled in 1969, and they were right in the middle of a five-year mission. You know, Kirk used to say at the beginning of every show, these are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. It's five-year mission to explore strange new worlds, et cetera, et cetera. Well, they never finished their five-year mission. They got canceled abruptly. And the next time anyone saw Captain Kirk, Mr. Spock, Dr. McCoy, was 10 years later, 1979, in Star Trek The Motion Picture. But if you saw that movie, Jim, Captain Kirk was now an admiral. He wasn't even the captain of the Enterprise anymore. He was an admiral at Starfleet. Mr. Spock had gone back to Vulcan, to his home planet. Dr. McCoy had quit the service altogether and gone home. Everybody had gone their separate ways. And so my idea was, let's pick up the series as if they had never been canceled and fill the gap and craft a story that explains why everyone was where they were when the motion picture begins. And as Mark said, our final two-part finale episode returns the Enterprise to Earth. It completes the five-year mission. The ship goes into dry dock to begin the refit that it was completing at the beginning of Star Trek The Motion Picture. And we craft a story to explain why everyone was where they were when the motion picture begins. It's a beautiful filler to tie the original Star Trek series to the motion picture that was released 10 years later.
And that's quite a expansive gap to, I mean, not only time-wise, but as you were mentioning, in the story, which I'm glad you did. So
right.
I've got the most trivial, I mean, my listeners are popping all kinds of good questions, and I've got the most trivial question in the history of man, but I'm going to ask it because it's my show. Why Georgia?
Well, I will tell you, number one, the cost of living down there is insanely low. We had an 18,000 square foot building where we rebuilt the entire soundstage of the Enterprise sets and even built a planet set inside, very much like they did in the original series. And to have a building like that, we would never have been able to do this production in a major city like a Los Angeles or a Chicago or New York or whatever. the costs would be completely prohibitive. But I was helping another fan production, I was helping another Star Trek fan production, and they had a small facility in Georgia. They had a small building where they had built a replica of a portion of the bridge and a portion of a couple of the sets. It wasn't a very big building, but they had a couple of pieces, and I helped them make an episode, and we forged a friendship, and we decided that we would pool our resources, so to speak. and I put up the money to acquire a larger building just down the street from the smaller building they were already in. And they were needing to vacate that small building anyway, and so they moved their portion of the sets that they had built over to the new big facility, and then we began laying out on the floor the plans to build everything else. The big bending corridor, the briefing room, sick bay, transporter room, captain's quarters, Jeffrey's tube, even engineering. And that's what we did, and that's why we ended up down there. And I will tell you, I absolutely love this little town. It's called Kingsland, Georgia. It's a submarine base, and it is right on 95 on the way to Disney. It's a wonderful little city with tons of hotels, restaurants, wonderful people living there. Cost of living is low, and every year, twice a year, me and all of my cast and crew would fly into Jacksonville, Florida, and just pop 25 minutes down the highway to Kingsland, Georgia, and spend 8 or 10 days shooting an episode of Star Trek Continues.
Thank you for answering why I knew that town in Georgia. Because
Of course.
And that saved me some Google right there.
And I'll tell you something else. If any of your listeners out there have ever dreamed of what it would be like to walk through the original soundstage, the original Enterprise Star Trek sets, May 24 to 26, we are going to have an open house. There is no charge. There is no price to get in. We are opening the doors for people who love Star Trek to come and walk through the soundstage and take pictures of themselves standing on the transporter platform, sitting in the captain's chair. And I tell you what, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. I'm going to be down there. Some of our other cast and crew members will be down there giving tours, meeting fans, talking about the building of the set and the making of our series. People can find out about it by going to the Neutral Zone Studios or Neutral Zone Studios and finding out the details of the when and the where and all of that.
So, Mark, I want to ask you, for all these courses of memos and documents that you went through, I hate to ask this because I know you guys just kind of built this big bridge to the movie, but was there anything left for continuing this project down the road?
You mean as far as doing other books or revised books? Or
more of the series, I guess, is where I'm headed.
Oh, well, no. We finished our series.
Star Trek Continues. Yeah. Okay.
We finished our series. My goal was always to finish the 5-year mission. Now, I will tell you, Jim, that we had originally wanted to make at least 13, maybe 15 episodes. And partway through the production of our series, some things in the landscape and the CBS position towards fan films changed based on a couple of things that we are not going to talk about. But due to circumstances beyond our control, basically we realized that we needed to wrap it up sooner rather than later. So we were able to shoot and finish 11 episodes, but we did what we set out to do, which had never been done before, and that was finishing what is arguably the most iconic series in television history.
Well, I'm glad you got it done, because I could just imagine the tragedy it would have been to get close again and then have it.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
I'll
tell you, Jim, I mean, because I'm not as close to the show as Vic is, so I'll toot the horn for him. I did some writing for the show, and as I said, I was a script consultant on a lot of the episodes and so on. But it's Vic's baby, and him and his people did an amazing job. And we did a screening in Los Angeles because a couple of the episodes that they did are kind of continuations of episodes that were done for Star Trek, where you wondered, I wonder what happened because of that. And so they answered that question. And there was one an episode called Mirror Mirror. And Vic did an episode called Fairest of Them All, which kind of picks up that story where it left off, and it was a story that needed to be picked up. And we screened both the original episode, Mirror Mirror, from 1967, and Fairest of Them All from about 4 years ago, I guess, is when that one was shot. And right after the Mirror Mirror, we took a break. And everybody could go out and stretch their legs and so on, and then they came back into the auditorium, dimmed the lights, started Fairest of Them All, and there was a gasp through the room, because it's the same sets, it's the same lighting, the same, I mean, it's like you took an intermission and the story continues, and the actors switched out, but these actors are all so good and look the parts and sound the parts, and that within minutes, you just accept it. It's not like anybody changed whatsoever, especially when you have people like Chris Doohan playing his dad's role, and they look so much alike and sound so much alike and so on. And so it was really an interesting experience for me to be in that auditorium and watch an original episode of Star Trek and then the part two that was made, and they feel like they were made side by side at the same time by the same people. And so it's a very interesting experience. So I highly recommend to anybody listening, if you haven't seen the show, there's no charge. Just go to StarTrekContinues.com, and you can watch any of these fantastic episodes.
Yeah, all free. We didn't make it to make money. We made it for love of the original series and to say thank you to the original series for how much it inspired me when I was a little boy, and I'm not alone. There are millions of others that were so inspired by that show. And most, you know, thank you for all the kind words too, Mark. And Jim, let me tell you that one of the most common things we hear is, oh my gosh, after 10 minutes, I forgot I was watching a fan series. I literally felt like I was watching episodes that had been locked in a vault for 50 years. So I'm very, very proud of our team and what we accomplished. I have a feeling that it will outlast all of us, and, you know, decades from now, people will watch the original Star Trek, and then they'll watch Star Trek Continues, and then they'll watch the first Star Trek movie and go forward from there.
So, Mark, I'm going to ask you this, and then, Vic, you can chime in, because I'm sure you're going to have an opinion on this question. And not just Star Trek, but as these series continue to go on, like Star Wars and just any number of series, is there going to come a point where the consumers get tired of just adding layer upon layer on it, or am I just misimagining things and want new, something new once in a while?
Well, we can hope that they do. You know, I don't quite understand Star Wars. I loved the first movie when it came out in 77, and I was about maybe 17 or 18, and I went to the theater, and they hadn't made a fun movie in a few years. You know, everything was getting so slow and serious and dark, and it was just a great roller coaster ride. And the second one was not quite as much, and the third one was not quite as much, and so on. And you know, the thing that I have about Star Trek compared to Star Wars is Star Trek was about something. You know, there was Gene Roddenberry always wanted to know what the theme of every story would be, and he wanted there to be a message behind every story, and he wanted all these episodes to look at ourselves, to look at humanity through the eyes of a Vulcan, to look at humanity through the eyes of people on other planets, and so on, and deal with the issues that are happening today in our lives and on our world, but using science fiction to help tell that type of a story, which is using science fiction very responsibly and to full effect. And so I think it's gotten diluted with some of the sequels, both of Star Trek and Star Wars and a lot of these other things. I don't see the purpose behind a lot of these programs. They're certainly entertaining, but it's kind of like you walk out hungry for a real movie after you see it, or hungry for a real TV show after you see it, because it's entertaining, but there's not a lot of substance to it for me. So that's my opinion. I think it's gonna taper off unless the people who are the caretakers of these shows and these movie series start giving us something that we can really chew on, something that's got a little more significance and importance. I think Star Trek Continued did, and I totally agree with Rod Roddenberry that I think his dad, Gene, would have called this canon. I don't know if he would have called some of the other Star Trek series canon. I don't think he would have liked yeah. personally, but I know he would have liked Star Trek Continues.
Yeah, I agree with Mark. You know, Jim, there's a reason that we're still talking about Star Trek, and Star Trek is still topical 55 years after this television show was made. Star Trek is still popular not because of the special effects. It's not popular because of the, of the models or the sets or the costumes. It's popular because of the storytelling. The storytelling was topical and it was relevant. It was thematic. It had a moral to a story. It had a point to make. And when I decided that we were going to make Star Trek Continues, I was fully committed that was the kind of, those were the kind of stories we were going to tell. Star Trek is not about, beaming down. Star Trek is not about firing phasers or running around in a costume and flipping open a communicator. Star Trek was about real human issues. And so we worked really, really hard to tell those kind of stories. And I think that's one of the many ways that our series resonates and it is so well received. But I also think that, Star Wars, look, I loved Star Wars. When I was a little kid and Star Wars came out, the first three movies, I was completely enthralled. I loved it. But, the new movies are just, they kind of leave me flat because there's just not much new to tell. There's really nowhere else that they're not going anywhere new. They seem to be regurgitating the same ideas as the original Star Wars movie, only instead of Darth Vader, it's Kylo Ren. Instead of Luke Skywalker, it's the girl, Rey. And instead of the Death Star, it's another Death Star. And instead of the Emperor, it's the, what's his name? It's just literally, they're even flying around in the same ships, and it literally seems to be just more of the Empire is chasing the Rebellion again. And I feel like really quality storytelling is really missing in a lot of films and television.
I agree. It's the lost art, I think, storytelling. I mean, just in television, movies, people even anymore. Just the lost art of telling stories. But that's a whole other can of worms for another day.
Yeah.
Vic, you mentioned earlier that you might want to cut out a few minutes early. That's fine. But can you give me your website, your Facebook, where people can find you?
Sure, absolutely. You can find me on Twitter at Vic Mignogna. Certainly find me and our entire production staff and cast and crew at StarTrekContinues.com. Like us on Facebook as well. My fan club website is www.risembool-rangers.com. RISEMBOOL Rangers.com. I do a lot of event appearances around the country. I've got shows. I just was at a show in Tupelo this past weekend. I was at a show in Dallas a few weeks ago. I'm going to be signing and doing an appearance at shows in Tennessee and Houston and Savannah and Puerto Rico, all coming up here very soon. So if any of your listeners happen to see me at a show near them, please come and say hello.
So I've got to have you back because we've talked about like 1% of what you've done in your life. So
yeah, let's definitely do it.
Thanks,
let's definitely
Vic.
Do it. Thank you so much, guys. Thanks, Mark.
Bye, Vic.
So Mark.
And then there were two.
Now there's
two. There were two, Jim.
I want to spread out on you now because, like I said, there's so much more that you've done that it's just remarkable. So that's why I kind of made sure to get a little drill down a few times too because the few things that I wrote down, the scribbled down that you wrote that I know about is like Beyond Belief.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a TV series on Fox, Beyond Belief, Fact or Fiction. And it had Jonathan Frakes of Star Trek Continues was the host. And before him, I was with the show both when Frakes was there and the guy before him. Who was the guy before him? He's married to Barbara Streisand. He used to be on Marcus Welby, MD. And I can't think of his name at the moment.
It'll come to us, or one of my listeners will start shouting at us here in a minute.
Yeah, one of your listeners. Who played the young doctor on Marcus Welby, if they can remember back that far? But he's currently married to Barbara Streisand. He's a good actor, and he was the host on that show. But we told stories on there about you got to decide. The viewers would try to figure out if it was a true story or one we were making up. But they were all about supernatural encounters and ghosts and strange events and so forth. And some of them were very well documented. Some of them were part of folklore. Some of them we just made up. And then at the end of each show, Jonathan would get up there and say, okay, and he'd go through the four episodes that had been shown during that hour and four 15-minute episodes and let you know which ones were based on what people think is true or ones that we'd kind of fudged a bit. That was a fun show to work on. I enjoyed that.
So James Brolin is the answer to our trivia question.
James Brolin, thank you. How can we not think? How could we forget James Brolin's name?
It happens to the best of us. Now, I really like that show. Yeah. So are you a believer in that type of thing, or was that just straight right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I have an open mind about everything. I think most writers do. And Gene Roddenberry was the same way. You know, he believed, as I do, that there's life on other planets. Absolutely. How could there not be? When you look up in the sky and see all those millions of stars and know that there's planets rotating around all of them, even if one out of every million only has life, you know, that's still billions of planets out there that could be supporting life, and some of those have to have creatures who have crawled out of the muck like mankind has. And
are you sure about that? Have we crawled out of the mud yet? I know it seems like we have.
I think we're getting pulled back into the muck, actually, it seems. But, I believed in that stuff, and Gene did too, not at first. He became a believer in the late 70s. I have a new two-book set out covering Roddenberry and Star Trek throughout the 1970s. She'll say, well, wait a minute, Star Trek was from the 60s. Well, I covered that in that three-book set we talk about. And in the 1970s, NBC cancels it, yet it becomes more and more popular each year. And the conventions come, which were the template for today's supercons, and the boom in syndication and merchandising, and then Star Trek the Animated Series came on, and then Star Trek the Motion Picture by the end of the decade. And Gene Roddenberry was also doing several other pilot films during that era. And so this book covers all that. And one of the things he was doing that I found very interesting researching was he was doing a thing on the 10, or I'm sorry, the nine. And it was a group out of New York State who hired him to write a screenplay about aliens coming to Earth who had been here before and wanting to prepare man for their arrival. And they had a channeler come in, and the channeler talked on behalf of the aliens to him, and Gene interviewed the channeler and asked all kinds of questions about who they were and their technology and when they had been here before, and it's eerie. You know, I went through all the transcripts and everything, and it was just fascinating to me. And I talked to his assistant Susan Sackett, who was working with him at that time, and she said, you know, Gene always believed in life on other planets, but after doing that, he kind of walked away with enhanced beliefs on all kinds of unexplainable events, because they did some out-of-body experiments and experiences and so on. And so he and Susan kind of got startled about some things. But he always had an open mind, and I try to as well. I believe most writers do. You know, we don't close the door on anything, because how are we to know?
So the other thing that maybe it's just my space, the podcast space, the internet radio space, that seems to be going out of this planet right now is true crime. And I noticed you wrote for Diagnosis Murder.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess, is it just the general morbid curiosity that people always have had? Why that space is growing so fast?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Look, it's always been popular. I mean, look at it. Alfred Hitchcock back in the 30s and 40s and 50s. People always loved crime stories, and the more gruesome, the better. And, you know, it's... I did a script with a terrific writer named Melody Fox. We did a script... What was the name of the show? Law and Order. And I remember we had to talk to the Los Angeles County Coroner, and because we were trying to decide if this body, all those stories were based on true stories. All the Law and Order ones were based on headlines out of the newspaper. And there was one about this body that was discovered in a storage locker in New York in the middle of summer. It was starting to stink to high heavens. It had been in there a long, long time. So we had to call the coroner to find out if they could raise fingerprints off of it, and how long would it be before they could identify it and solve a murder based on this corpse and things of that nature. And I remember it was so interesting for both of us, because the coroner was just really got into it. Well, you know what you want to do. If you want not to get caught, then you got to... I remember looking at Melody and saying, you know, they didn't even ask to see our Writers Guild cards. As far as they know, we could just be serial killers try to get some professional advice on how to get away with a crime. But I think it's human nature. I mean, you look at how popular Game of Thrones is right now, and it's a very morbid series, and Dexter and so forth, which I thought was a very good show. I thought, you know, how can we watch a show about a serial killer? Well, because he's killing other serial killers. He's the best guy in the show. And so it's, you know, if you do it right, you can do it. You know, I always loved, there was a show on in the 70s called Columbo, Peter Falk, you may recall.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing about Columbo was actually the antagonist in that show. And it had never been done before. You know, on TV shows and movies, you always have the protagonist, the lead character, the person we root for. And with Columbo, in every episode, the protagonist was the killer, the murderer. The episode would always start with the murderer. And he would try so hard, they wanted to see if the audience could cheer for a murderer and hope that he could get away with it, because he tried so hard to come up with the perfect murder. And then Columbo would come walking into the story 20 minutes into it, in his ruffled raincoat and very kind of annoying personality, and cute but annoying. And so he was the antagonist. He was the guy who came in and tried to ruin the murderer's perfect plans. And so it was an interesting experiment with that show to see if the audience could get behind a killer. And it did. That show ran for over a decade. So, you know, it's human nature to enjoy this kind of stuff, and it goes back to the beginning of time, to the earliest forms of storytelling. I mean, nothing's more morbid than fairy tales. And, the things we were told when we were kids, Hansel and Gretel and all that stuff, you know? It's all, you know, throwing kids in the oven. You know, it's been like that since ever. It's just part of human nature.
So what, I mean, I'm not going to ask you to date yourself, but what's the biggest challenge now as opposed to then? Because TV has changed, I don't want to say 180 degrees since probably when you started, but it's probably close.
Yeah. Well, I started working in the 80s, and and it was my busiest in the 90s and into the new millennia. And I kind of got out of it about 10 years ago. I still get pulled in to do things now and then, asked to do things, but I kind of got into writing the books, which I really am enjoying at this point after doing hundreds and hundreds of scripts. You get bored of that after a while. But it was easier to tell stories back then, and even before then, before my time, because you didn't have all the technology that gets in the way of telling a good story. I mean, think about this, Jim. You know, you want to tell a story about a lady in distress, you know, out on the back highways, and her car breaks down, and she gets picked up by some bad characters and all this type of stuff. Well, you could tell those kind of stories, or any kind of story like that, back in the days, if you were writing westerns or if you were writing contemporary shows back in the 60s and 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, all that. But now, you know, everybody's got cell phones. Everybody's got computers. I mean, nobody's really alone. You look at a movie like Deliverance. If you remember Deliverance with Burt Reynolds, now I was a teenager when that came out, but they're out on that raft in the backwaters, and they get taken captured by a bunch of the mountain men who live up there, and all these horrible things happen to them. Well, you couldn't tell that kind of a story today because all those guys would have cell phones. You know, the minute something like this would happen, they would call 911, and the helicopters would come flying in. So it's getting a little harder to tell good, believable stories because of all the technology. Everything's easy, and it's not man against the element so much anymore. You know, you got all this support. So there's only three kinds of stories: man against man against nature, and man against himself. But you know, when you bring in all this technology, it's hard for you to have one person against anything. The cavalry can come over the hill at any moment if he just dials three numbers on his cell phone. So that's kind of changed storytelling a lot, but also the audience's sensitivities have changed. You know, we're now a generation that doesn't really focus on things too much. You know, with the cell phones and all the bombardment of technology that we get, that people's attention spans aren't as long as they used to be. And so they get bored much easier and bounce around a lot more. So you have to fashion stories that are going to hold somebody's interest. You can't do something that's going to have too much dialogue or make the audience think too much. It's got to keep a lot of action and a lot of gross jokes and everything else to keep people from flipping channels or speeding through it or anything like that. So entertainment is changing constantly, and it's going to accelerate. We're going to see a lot of big changes in the way entertainment is presented in the next few years. Keep in mind, we've only had the internet for what? Not even 20 years, probably. And look how much has changed in the last 20 years with the coming of cell phones and the internet. And that's going to just speed up.
Yeah, and reliable internet and fast internet for the last, what, 5, 10 maybe. I mean, the old dial-up that, you know, anyways, that's a whole other story for another day.
Yeah, I remember that. Oh, my God, it took forever. everybody's in the room all excited, like, hey, we have American Online, and look at it, we're going to get onto the Internet, and you'd wait for an hour, and it seemed exciting. Nobody would have any patience for that now. No, the world's changing. It's changing quickly. It's accelerating in ways that we never could even imagine. But, you know, everybody's still got their comfort places. You've got your favorite shows that you can go watch. Those things don't go away. You got your favorite movies, your favorite music. So even if what Hollywood and the entertainment industry is dishing out right now isn't your flavor, if you don't like it, well, then there's you got all the classic stuff. I mean, there's more stuff that you would have. It'd take 20 lifetimes to watch all the stuff that's out there. The good stuff. I'm not talking about the junk, just good stuff. So there's plenty to watch, and there's plenty to listen to, and there's plenty to do. And shows like yours where people can get interesting information, interesting conversation, and so forth, instead of just sitting in front of the networks and watching these reality TV shows, which are not reality. I've worked on a lot of those shows, and they're not reality at all. It's all made up.
Don't crush me like that. No, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. Don't tell me about the Easter Bunny, okay?
it's not totally made up. It's real people, real places, but we manipulate it. You know, when they hire writer-directors like me, And so we don't have scripts to work off of, but we go out there with these real people and we'll kind of cheat. You know, like if they're betting on a storage locker, they know what's inside already. We already opened it up and we all walked through there and saw it. So all this stuff where it's like, gee, I wonder what if I made a good buy and I wonder what's under this rug and what's in that box. Well, they did feel that. It was real because, you know, when we opened up the doors and went in there, they wanted to know. But by the time you turn the cameras on, you already know where, hey, okay, so we're going to row and go over there and look disappointed, but then go over there and look in that thing because that's where the good stuff is. You know, because you need to know that. You need to know how to light it and everything else. You're not just going to row cameras and hope that something interesting happens. So it is real people, it is real situations, but it's all been kind of rehearsed and everything. So by the time the cameras start turned on, it's not really reality.
It's funny you mentioned that particular brand of show, because there's the original, and then as they kept spinning it off and spinning it off and spinning it off, and I think on like the fifth or sixth spinoff, you could tell that like it was, you could just see the production in it.
Yeah.
At least I could. I'm like, wow, this is really bad, because they're trying to cookie cutter this guy into that, the main, you know, you look back at the main show and that's, they're trying to do that to him, but he's not that guy. And
yeah, when you think about it, you know, like in that type of a show where a Storage Wars, and there's a whole bunch of them like that, and then they get the what might be the treasure, and they take it to the local antique dealer or pawn shop or whatever to find out if it's worth anything, and watch those shows, and you'll notice when the person comes into the pawn shop, there's a shot of him coming in the door, there's a shot of the guy behind the counter. There's a shot of the two of them as he walks up to the counter and shows the guy a thing. There's a close-up of the thing that they're looking at, and so on and so on. Well, look, we don't go in there with 10 cameras. We go in there with maybe two. So you're obviously setting the shots up. So you walk through the whole thing. So when the guy jumps on his computer and he looks it up to see if it's a valuable collectible thing, he's already done that. We've already walked in and showed him what the thing is. He's already gone and looked it up. And so what we're basically doing is we're restaging it for the camera. And I like True TV a few years ago. They said it's not reality, it's actuality. And I like the honesty of that. With shows like Dog the Bounty Hunter and so forth, you know, they were doing his cases, but he was reenacting the cases. None of this was really happening at that moment. It was all reenactments. So, you know, so yes, it happened. So there is an element of reality to this stuff, but not, I mean, if you want to watch reality, watch Cops. That's probably the only reality show that's out there, or something like that, where they're just out riding along and shooting what's going on. You know, but about anything else is recreated for the camera.
Are they still making Cops?
Oh yeah, yeah. I know. It's I was flipping channels the other night, and I came across it's on a new channel now. The Paramount Channel or something, and Monday nights. I saw it. I thought, oh, I didn't even know they were making this anymore. You know, it's always on somewhere, but you just figure it's reruns. No, that show's been in production since, I think, 1989. It's been a long run for that show.
So, Mark,
it's a cheap show to do.
We are rapidly running out of time. Where can people find you?
Yes, I'm wasting all my time talking about Cops. I should be talking about what I need to sell. You can find me at markcushman.com. I have my website, but don't go there. Just go to theseofthevoyagesbooks.com, and you'll find my Star Trek books, which are put out by a company called Jacobs Brown Press. And they also have the new audiobook that we were talking about earlier that Vic did. I've done books on Irwin Allen shows. I did books on I Spy, because it was the first show to do an interracial casting American film around the world, and then the Star Trek books, and I did one on the Moody Blues, because nobody had ever done a biography on the Moody Blues, and I was shocked. So I did one last year. And so you can go find that stuff there.
Views
if you're interested
and opinions expressed
what I'm
on the Mallard Report are
and,
those of the host and participants.
Well, Mark,
but I hope you do.
I have to have you back, because there's a lot more to talk
social
about there as well.
Links,
but for tonight,
so
thank you
more.
So much.
Visit Mallard.
You're welcome. Thank you, Jim.
MALLIARD.com. And thanks for listening.
Don't you know that you're a grown-up?
I'm a grown-up.
Me too.
Yep, me too. But you know, these days, being a grown-up can really suck.
Luckily, we're grown-ups who grew up in the coolest generation.
We had video arcades.
And also some of the best TV and movies ever made.
We lived the origin of awesome consumer electronics. The list goes on and on.
Yep, Generation X.
Exactly.
And we're Gen X Grown-Up.
Every week, the Gen X Grown-Up podcast explores media, tech, toys, games, and more from both yesterday and today.
Through the eyes of Generation Xers who absolutely love that stuff. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
Or find us on our website, GenXGrownUp.com. All right, you think that was good enough?
I hope so, man. I'm tired.
Who listens to a promo on a podcast and then goes and listens to a different podcast?
Right.
I've never done it.
No. Right.